Hello, and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and the Christian moral worldview is without doubt facing a great moment of conflict as it grapples with kind of the secularist moral worldview in many areas of life, but particularly when it comes to questions about human identity. Christianity and modern secularism are at odds. Among the most important of those human identity questions, of course, are the questions about manhood and womanhood. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? Christianity and modern secularism give vastly different answers. Today we talk with author and speaker Jared Zimmerer about manhood as Christ intended it, a husband and father almost of six, right, Jared?
You're expecting
number six. Jared is the director of outreach and mission at Word on Fire Catholic Ministries. Bishop Barron's founded that ministry, and he's the founder of his own ministry called Strength for the Kingdom. He's also the author of several books, most recently Man Up, Becoming the New Catholic Renaissance Man. Jared Zimmerer, thank you for being with us today on Catholic Answers Focus.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's been great.
So let's start at the beginning. Who taught you to be a man?
Well, I think in large part my grandfather and my dad. They were both, you know, they're good Texas boys that we're pretty much country growing up. And in large part, my dad was the type of guy that, you know, you could always trust him. And that was something that I really understood right away. It was part of being a man, that if you make a promise, you always follow through with it. And so it was, you know, it's funny because I grew up in a Catholic home. My father was a German Catholic growing up, and that was very ingrained in him. My mother was actually a convert to Catholicism. She was Episcopalian growing up. She converted right around the same time I received my first communion. And so pretty much a normal Catholic household in every sense of the word. We prayed the rosary at least two or three times a week together. Oftentimes we would go to monthly confession as a family. Afterwards, we'd go out to eat, you know, make a deal out of it. Every summer, we went to this organization called the Apostolate for Family Consecration and spent a summer there either volunteering or participating in catechetical and evangelization opportunities. And so it was a very normal thing to call myself Catholic growing up. But in large part, the faith was going to my head and not necessarily to my heart. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because this question about what does it mean to be a man really was step one for me to become a better Catholic. Right around my sophomore year of college, I started to kind of look at my life and wonder the question of, you know, what am I doing? You know, I was looking at my peers, I was living the typical college lifestyle, and just started to realize, like, I grew up thinking I was going to have an opportunity to be like the next Braveheart or the next Gladiator type guy, and yet the college campus wasn't offering it to me.
So what, the image of manhood that you found on the college campus, it didn't match with the image that you had been raised with. Is that what you're?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. You know, the partying and the girl chasing and all the craziness that happens on most college campuses. I went to a state university, just a normal, typical university. And, you know, in large part, faith was not talked about in most of my circles. You know, I was mostly at the gym. That's kind of where I spent most of my time. And in large part, you know, that idea of having a mission and a purpose in your life, that was almost nil while I was there. I mean, it was pretty much, let's just live for today, and let tomorrow handle itself. And I knew in my heart that wasn't right, that there had to be something deeper here. There had to be something, giving me purpose in my life. And so, I started to kind of take a step back and wonder the question of what does it mean to be a man? And interestingly, I think it's because I just tried to be cool on the college campus, but I went back to the ancient Greeks and Romans. I went to Cicero and Epictetus and Seneca and many of them, and really dive deep into the virtue ethics of the ancient Romans and Greeks. And through them, through their teaching about duty and honor and responsibility and all of that, it geared me right into a better understanding of Thomas Aquinas and the Catechism and Fulton Sheen. And it made me realize that ultimately what it means to be a man is that my life is not about me. That my life is meant to be a sacrifice for others. And you can read that in the ancient Greeks and Romans, that they were all about being a good citizen, about looking for the community, about, you know, striving for excellence. And I saw that in its best in Christ. And by the grace of God, it was very easy for me to make that connection with Catholicism and say, well, Catholicism is what's striving to make me excellent in myself and make me a better man, and providing the sacraments, providing opportunities for me to be a great man. And so really, this whole kind of mixture of manhood and Catholicism was sort of my journey into taking this as my own.
When you look at the condition of the secular culture and the kind of the secular moral worldview that people are increasingly living, having rejected, I think, or in many cases maybe never having truly been exposed to the Christian moral worldview, the Christian moral universe, do you think that or maybe I should put it this way, how do you think that manhood is impoverished in that view, in the secularist view?
Yeah, I think in large part, and I'm going to borrow from Bishop Barron for a minute, but the secularist worldview is often quite bland and beige. You know, I think that manhood suffers from any type of relativism, because to be a true man, you have to know who you are, and you have to have a very sure foundation in what that is. And relativism, you know, this whole subjective mentality of my truth is my truth and yours is yours. Well, manhood does not fit in that, because masculinity by necessity needs to have a mission and a purpose in life. And if you end up subjectively creating that mission, then it becomes boring. I mean, it becomes all about you. It becomes about your own ego. It becomes about your own ability to rise in the world. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can be misguided. And all of a sudden, it's all about the ego and not necessarily about mission and purpose. I think that two things that are really hurting men today, one is that we no longer really know what authentic friendship between men look like anymore. I think that even the idea of authentic friendship has been scarred or skewed because of this relativism that's out there. And I think men in particular get hurt worse, because by nature, we are meant to sharpen one another. We're meant to have, I continue to use the word tribe because I just love that word, but we're meant to have our own tribes to reach out to, men that we're close to, that we can literally spill our heart out to if we need to, but then also who will challenge us back. And then I think the second one is simply the missing of challenge of being excellent. The secular worldview simply doesn't offer as deep as something like Catholicism does when it strives for excellence in your life. Because if it's subjective, well, then your excellence is by your own bar. Whereas in Catholicism, we have the bars of the saints that tell us what's excellent and what's not. And so we have a very direct vision on what that mission is. And so it kind of corrals the intensity that is manhood and points it in a very specific direction to become excellent and great.
Well, you know, in preparing for our interview, I was thinking about who are images of fathers, and fatherhood is so important to manhood. And Atticus Finch was the first one I could come up with. I was looking at like movie images, and Atticus has a set of values that he lives by, and he's very manly, but not macho. And could you maybe, because I think a lot of people, when they hear us talk about manhood or manliness, they have a view, oh, well, we're talking about being macho or machismo. Those are not the same thing, are they?
No, they're not. No. I would say that the idea of machismo in particular is an ego-driven masculinity, it's ultimately about me. And I say that, you know, the problem with a lot of modern visions of masculinity and femininity is that it has limited what those mean. You know, if you look at the saints, you've got an incredibly wide range of masculinity and femininity. So in one vein, you've got Pier Giorgio on one side, Alphonsus Liguori on another, and then Pope John Paul II on another. And they all represent a true masculinity within Catholicism. And yet there's this huge range of masculinity. And so while we're all going to have our own temperaments, our own personalities, the beauty of something like Catholicism is that they all fit into that view of masculinity. I say the same thing about femininity. You know, today, if you have a woman who perhaps more adheres to, say, like, a Joan of Arc, right? She's more of a fighter, more wants to get out in the world and do these things. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have Thérèse of Lisieux, who never left the convent and yet was extremely, you know, feminine and full in her femininity. So you have these two great examples of what femininity can be, so long as it's within the context of striving to meet Christ and be who you are as a personality and as a person. And so I completely agree with you that unfortunately what has happened is we've only thrown out the kind of archetypes of masculinity that are, say, the machismo or perhaps the metrosexual or, you know, even today it's more of there's kind of a wimpiness out there that says that that's what authentic masculinity ought to be. But the problem with that is that it doesn't take into account the true person. That within all of us, we've got these sides of us that one might, you know, I've got an intense side and that's why I lift weights. But then I also have this kind of loving and charitable side, which comes out whenever I'm with my wife or with my daughter or with my boys. You know, you have to have this range. And if we kind of pigeonhole it into only machismo, unfortunately, we're going to continue skewing the idea of what it means to be a man.
Indeed. And I want to get to you to talk about fitness a bit because you've written books on fitness and you and this is part of the practice of your daily life, your asceticism, I would think, to some degree. But I want to stay just for a minute on this idea of manhood and what has happened to manhood. And you said, you know, male friendship, for example, you said, is, I think there are so many men who don't have friends, like real and certainly not friends who they love fulsomely. You know, like the ancients would have seen male friendship as a great good. And I wonder if sometimes we see friendship. Well, for one, every relationship now, I'm just going to suggest this to you and see what you think, has become sexualized.
Yes.
Because of there's something about the hypersexualization of society that means every intimate relationship has just this kind of aura of potential sexuality around it, which makes it harder for men to love one another. First of all, let's start there. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You hit the nail right on the head because, and again, it's coming from this limiting view of what these words mean and what these emotions mean. And you're right too, that studies have shown that the average middle-class American male today is the most lonely in pretty much all of the United States. Where I'm talking just about the United States, but it might be a problem, of course, elsewhere too. But I think that what I like to go back to is Aristotle's kind of levels of friendship and point out that not all of it is the eros, right? That it's not always intimate, that it's not always physical. I mean, some guys today can't even hug each other because they feel like it's a little bit odd and that it's going to be sexualized in some way. And that's unbelievably skewed when it comes to men being with each other.
Right.
We need to be able to, I mean, even the ability to kind of spill your soul to another man, that in a certain sense is a type of intimacy that cannot and should not be sexualized. Right. But it's so healthy for men to be able to do that with one another and to feed off of one another and challenge one another. You know, by the grace of God, I've got a very, very close friends here in my hometown here. And so I'm able to grow together and they're all good Catholic men with large families just like me. So it helps. And they're also physically active. They're seeking, you know, the depth of knowledge in the faith. And I can't tell you how often I need to just go to that. It's part of, I think, the masculine genius, if you will, to continue to go back to men. In fact, if it's been like, say, 2 months since I've had an opportunity to go hang out with them, I just go to my wife and say, listen, I gotta have some guy time. And she trusts me because she knows my friends. She knows I'm not about to go hit up the bars or do anything crazy. I'm about to go either lift weights or just go sit around a campfire and go hang out with some guys. You just need it. There's something innate in us that says that. And I think you're absolutely right that the biggest problem we've got today is that we've over-sexualized what that means.
Well, let me ask you then about sexual restraint, because you mentioned the ancients, and I'm not familiar with all of them, but Cicero I'm familiar with, and certainly sexual restraint is manly in the ancient world. It's thought, but today where it's almost as if you're a goat, you know, like the more you, like a goat you are, then the more manly you are. But we're not made to be goats. We're not made to just rut, you know?
Yeah.
So can you say something about, you know, the Christian view of sexual restraint and how that's mocked in the world, but it is actually essential to being a man?
Yeah, and to kind of go back to the ancients to lead into Christianity, they believed that even they had this idea of higher passions and lower passions.
Ah.
And they understood that there was levels of humanity, then there ought to be some kind of directorship among them so that the lower passions where they belong. And so they knew that the mind and the life of the mind was way more important than, say, the life of the lower passions. And so you had to train yourself in virtue of the mind so that you can then guide the virtues of the lower passions. And so in Christianity, we see a fullness of that. We see a full expression of that by saying that you are made beautifully, you're made unique, and because of that, you now need to be able to control and express your passions in a certain way, shape, and form. And that means that there are sacraments set up to be able to guide those passions. There are you know, I think there's nothing more manly than being able to say, I am in control of my own self, right? I think it was Leo the Great that actually said that there's nothing truer than of a king than to say that my soul is God's and – or I'm sorry, my body is God's and the soul directs it, right?
Yeah.
That I am in control of who I am, and I do so through grace. I do so by asking Christ to guide me in those. And so, yeah, I mean, there's nothing more manly than to say, you know, I'm going to allow myself to take this little bit of pain so that I can become better. And that kind of leads into our fitness real quick, but it's an asceticism of soul. By saying that I know in this context, it's not right for me to express myself sexually or in any other way. It's the same thing as, you know, say you're in a conversation with someone and perhaps it gets a little bit heated. Well, what's the more manly thing to do? I think it's to take the stoic route, step back, take a look at the conversation and not blow up. Right? To really think through what's going on. Instead, if you just let your passions get a hold of you and you let it blow up, well, now you've shown yourself as someone who can't control their lower passions. And so in the same way, sexuality, yeah, it's like an engine. Like once it gets going, and sometimes it's hard to stop it. But it takes virtue. It takes asceticism. It takes stepping back and seeing objectively what's going on in your life right now and saying right now is not the right context to express myself.
So yeah, you have a degree in kinesiology and you're finishing a master's degree in theology. Is that right? Or is it?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. So with your undergraduate degree in kinesiology, obviously physical fitness and the body have been important to you and to understanding what you're doing there. So would it be fair to say you might have a spirituality of exercise and not just exercise, but of the body? And we always, well, of course, now when I say that, okay, we go right to John Paul's theology of the body. And I'm not asking you to do that. I mean a spirituality of the proper use of the body, including for you're a bodybuilder and a weight trainer and all that. What is your spirituality in that regard?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I kind of got into this based on so I got hurt in high school playing football. And because of that, the doctors basically said, you need to start lifting weights to keep your knees strong. That's the only way to keep this up. But then when I was in college, when that conversion started to happen, I was fully in the bodybuilding world, fully in the powerlifting world. And I kind of stepped back and said, well, is this going to be okay in Catholicism? Is bodybuilding and powerlifting something that can fit within the sphere of Catholicism? And so I started to sort of research, and my first place to go was theology of the body, obviously. Oh. But I also looked back at a lot of the ancient practices of asceticism. Unfortunately, asceticism is not talked about a lot today. It perhaps once Lent comes around, then you might hear that word thrown out every now and then. Almost everyone takes part in it during Lent. If they're, you know, giving up certain things and taking on other things, that's a certain type of asceticism. But if you look at some of, like, say, the desert monks, right? These guys were putting on like camel hair shirts, eating grasshoppers, sleeping on the floor. I mean, a very, very tough life. And they did it to basically grow in this kind of self-liquidation of saying, only Christ in me, only Christ in me. I give you my body completely. And they wanted to follow with St. Paul and say, only Christ in me. And so I realized that, you know, perhaps what asceticism needs is what I call a new asceticism, kind of a reawakening to asceticism. But what's something that people can partake in that are just the natural Joes in the pews today, right? I mean, I'm a married man with going on six kids. There's no way my wife's going to allow me to just go live in the desert and start eating grasshoppers. Just not going
to
work.
I bet someday she'd like you to. I'm just guessing. There must be some days that she'd like you to.
But she, but you know, I think that what fitness has appropriated, has given us, is opportunities to live the ascetic life, because you have to control your diet. You have to look at what you're eating. And I think that's perfect for today, because how easy is it to go hit up the closest fast food place as opposed to thinking through your meals, thinking about what you're eating? You know, we're all going 190 miles an hour all the time. And sometimes food is the last thing we think about. Most of the time, we are sitting behind a desk pretty much all day. And so the ability to have somewhere to go and physically express yourself and get out some of that tension, perhaps get out some of that anxiety that might be in you, and also to kind of focus on your diet, not so much as a vanity thing, but more as just a self-control thing, to say that, no, this week I'm only going to have two bad meals, and those two bad meals will be on Wednesday and Friday, and I'm going to eat a cheeseburger or whatever I want. But other than that, I'm going to be disciplined with myself.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that, no, I'm going to eat, eggs in the morning and chicken at night, or whatever you works for you. And the beauty of the fitness boom is that there's so much for each individual to choose from, whatever speaks to your personality. And to me, that's the sign of a good spirituality, that there's this kind of overarching vision, and then within that, now there's, you know, millions of different personalities within it, but they can all partake, right? I mean, I grew up really kind of heavily ingrained in the Carmelite and Benedictine spirituality. Absolutely love going on silent retreats. Absolutely love the Carmelite mentality of going to the internal kingdom, right? But yet, I'm not a Carmelite. I'm not a Benedictine, but my personality still fits in within that. And so in fitness, you have this big wide range of opportunities to physically engage. So for me, it's bodybuilding and powerlifting and strongman, but some people might be CrossFit, or some people just might want to go take a walk or hike, you know, once or twice a week. And so in that, what you're doing is you're recognizing the spiritual side of who you are through the body, right? I always say that what you do to the body matters to the soul, and what you do to the soul matters to the body. And that was something that the ancient Stoics picked up on, and that's why they believed in controlling the sexual passions and all of that, because they knew it hurts something deeper whenever you mistreat it. And so today, I think that what I call the new asceticism is basically a spirituality of fitness, of saying that, you know, for too long, the fitness world has pretty much been only about the look and the body. And I'm saying that there's something deeper here. You know, there's something good in here that we can expose, because that's what Christians do.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that what a lot of people don't realize is that they're partaking in something that's affecting them deeper. There's numerous stories of guys who got into bodybuilding after they were locked up, say, for 5-10 years or whatnot. They get out, get into bodybuilding, and all of a sudden clean up their life. Mm-hmm. They stop partying. They stop hanging out with the guys who have drugs and crime, because it deters them from their ultimate goal. So in a certain sense, what fitness has done for them is helped clean up their life. It put them on a right path. And I say it's because of the discipline and the asceticism that goes along with it.
Well, so self-mastery is actually a very, I mean, the Stoics would have been all about self-mastery, but that's a very Christian, Christians have, that's part of the Christian spirituality is this idea of self-mastery. And I wonder if in many ways, our world is so rich in opportunities, whether it's media opportunities or opportunities to eat delicious food or to make money and all that, that that we've missed this self-mastery thing, or we maybe just kind of let it slide to the point where we're not where we want to be. But your impressions of that?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because the catechism actually says, the number's slipping my mind right now, but the catechism says that without self-mastery, there is no salvation. Because through self-mastery, you're gaining grace. Christ is coming deeper into your life. In order to have a good prayer life, you have to have self-mastery. How easy is it to fall out of your prayer life? I mean, it's
right
until you do it over and over and over again, even when you don't want to, that's when you start getting a good prayer life. And that's when it just becomes second nature. And you're absolutely right that unfortunately the idea of self-mastery really didn't take in the secular culture. I think there's a lot of things that go into that, but I do think that there's these kind of undergirded things going on, like fitness, and you know, there's a growth of reemerging into the Stoics right now. That's booming, and so I think people are realizing that this kind of freedom at all costs didn't work, and so now they're trying to figure out, okay, well what does. And there's a boom right now again in the attraction toward self-mastery. And I think it's because they realized that the experiment of unbridled freedom failed.
It did indeed, right. But I wonder how if people are realizing that, it's awful slowly. I mean, how much destruction has to happen for us to realize that? Okay, so for me, though, I have to say, I could not have been a Stoic. It wouldn't have been enough to get me over myself to be a Stoic. But there is something so precious in self-mastery as a way of doing away with those things that are obstacles to Christ and building up those things that can attach me to Christ. Now it means something really different. It's something that this idea of just mastering oneself, maybe in a Stoic or a Buddhist way, it's for great people, not for mediocre people like me. But if we really come to believe that self-mastery means freeing ourselves from those things that keep us from Christ, and how great it is to have relationship with Christ, it's a whole different thing. It's a whole different world.
It goes much deeper. You know, I think that, you know, one of my favorite saints is Saint Alphonsus Liguori, and it's funny because one of my favorite books of his, as dark as it sounds, is called Preparation for Death.
Yeah.
and it's basically completely about self-relinquishing, of saying that my life's not about me, kind of going back to what we said at the beginning of chatting here, that really what self-mastery ought to garner is a recognition that your life is not about you, and that you need to sacrifice and live for other people. And we see that in its fullness in Christ and in Christ alone. That's the only place we see it in its fullness. And so I say that without Christ, self-mastery becomes somewhat of a practice, again, of the ego. Christ is the ultimate emptying of the ego. Because we strive not to be all about me, but rather all about Christ, right? It gears us towards living the life or life for another. And so you're right. I think that the Stoics were onto something, but not to its fullness. And we only see that in Christ.
But let me ask you this. What is the consequence, or what are the consequences for women and children if men take on this this kind of manliness, this Christian manliness that you are promoting? Is this a return to a time of, you know, male dominance and oppression of children and women, or how do you see it?
Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, again, it's I'm promoting self-sacrifice. So ultimately, if women want their husbands to be better, I would hope that they would want them to self-sacrifice, right? I mean, it's not fun getting up at 2 a.m. and going and changing a diaper. It's not fun, you know, doing the dishes and doing the things that you just really don't want to do. But when you have that higher purpose in mind and you know that part of being a good man is being there for your family and giving of yourself 100%, I say that it's a return back. I would say that, you know, manhood needs a renaissance again. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think, of course, it's kind of a little bit in the mind, but if you think of, you know, what Tolkien always brought up was chivalry, of this idea of knighthood again, and perhaps we, you know, romanticize that just a bit. But what it ultimately calls us to is a dying to self,
yeah,
and saying that I'm willing to give my life for you. You know, for a while prior to working for Word on Fire, I worked at a parish here in Texas, and part of my job was preparing people for marriage. And ultimately, what marriage is all about is becoming Christ for one another. Well, where's the greatest place to see Christ is a crucified Christ, right? So mm-hmm. by being willing to die to self, you become a better husband. You become a better father because your life becomes not about you anymore. And so I think that, you know, there is somewhat of a fear of masculinity today, unfortunately. And I think that that's a skewed understanding of what masculinity truly is, that masculinity ought to be about self-sacrifice and self-gift to the other.
And so you talk about Christ crucified. That's the moment of greatest – that's the pinnacle human moment, really. That's where no human being ever achieved humanity to a higher degree than Christ on the cross. So that is, in fact, our humanity. Well, I guess my question is the how do you, in your own life, where you clearly working out, being an athlete, doing these things, eating properly and all that is very, very important to you. Are you ever tempted towards a kind of selfishness or self-centeredness? Like, how do you, or do you have other people who check you on that, or how do you manage that?
Yeah, I think my best check is my wife. Uh-huh. and the beauty of it is that, I mean, we have this understanding. We have literally had conversations about it and just saying that, you know, this is something that I'm passionate about and I'm an intense guy, so if I'm either all in or all out sometimes. And I said, but know that I'm totally open to any time you need to tell me to cool off and back up a little bit. And so she has a few times. I mean, that's just, you know, the reality of it. But the, you know, I think that the vision of why I do it is what keeps me balanced. I do it because I desire to be a good husband and be a good father. Does that mean that I need to take, you know, 45 minutes a day or, you know, a couple hours a week to go work out? I think it does, because if I bring home the stress and anxiety of daily life and all these things, I'm not going to be as good of a husband and father, because that stress and anxiety is going to find a different outlet. And so it's preparing me better for them. And it also, one thing that fitness teaches you is that in order to become better, you have to deal with pain. You have to embrace the pain and push past the pain. Well, the same thing happens, I think, in family life. You know, it's not easy being a husband and father. It's not easy being a wife and a mother. But you realize that embracing that pain and just pushing through and inviting Christ into that moment, you become better ultimately. And so I think that for guys out there and girls out there that really take fitness seriously, it's look at how you view this. If it really is just about you, take a step back and realize what that's going to ultimately end up as. But if it's ultimately about being a good human being and desiring to be an excellent person to other people and be more loving, be more giving, be more charitable, then you're on the right path.
Well, the kind of I guess the over-plentitude, the exorbitant plentitude of our culture mitigates against that. Do you think and you said, you know, people are discovering the Stoics, but people are also – I mean the fitness thing has been since the 1970s, I think, been growing and people have a greater and greater awareness of that. But the part about finding Christ, do you think – well, let me just – I guess what I'm getting at is – your theology, your spirituality of fitness, of exercise, of kind of self training and self mastery and all that is beautiful. But do we approach people, or in your experience, is it better to you approach people to draw them into this care for themselves in this way, to do the, or is it, does Christ come first? You know, where do we, how do you evangelize in that way?
Sure. Yeah, I take the same route as Aquinas. You know, Aquinas would point out goods in a culture, goods in a teaching, and then say, now, if you want the fullness of it, you have to go to Jesus.
Ah.
That's just the reality of it. So,
yeah.
So in the fitness world, you're experiencing goods. These things are, you know, self-mastery, asceticism, these things that you're already partaking in. But now where's the fullness of that? Where's your why when it comes to doing all of these different things? If it's just about you, you know, big muscles are going to fade away, just the reality. You know, eventually we are all going to die. So if you're on your deathbed and you say, well, I spent hours and hours and hours in the gym for myself – what did that accomplish, right? I mean,
yeah.
Ultimately, that means the entire thing was all for naught. So let's give it purpose. Let's give it meaning. Let's find this good that's within it and say, good, good. Keep going. Now let me show you where the greatest treasure is. And I think that for fitness enthusiasts out there, in large part, what that requires from you is witness. From you, that you have to be willing to have those conversations. You have to be willing to grow those friendships and put forth the time and effort with these individuals because they're not going to trust you until they meet you on that common ground. And the beauty of fitness and bodybuilding and all these things is that that common ground can happen very, very quickly. I mean, within about 5 minutes of asking someone to spot you on the bench, you now have a new friend because they know that they can ask you to spot them. So now you've got this kind of connection here, and then you grow from there. And ultimately, in the back of your mind, you know, I'm wanting to introduce this person to Jesus. And if we can use this common ground to do so, then great.
In many ways, the gym is one of the last real social places where we actually can interact. Because everything or nearly everything in our society is designed to keep you in a bubble where you can – nobody bothers me. Nothing gets in here. I can drive up to a drive-up window. They'll just hand it to me, all that. It is really a very social thing.
It is. It is. And it's fun too because you know, you see other people's goals. You see what's going on. And one of the beauties of it – and I mean, unless you go to a bad gym, pretty much everyone there is there to get better. And so they're not going to criticize you. They're not going to put you down. They're not going to, you know, do these things that most of the modern world does on a regular basis. In the gym, you know, it's all about, you know, I'm either trying to lose weight, put on some muscle, get stronger. Everyone has their goals. Even if it's just, I just want to get in shape. You know, there's this kind of connection of desiring to be better. And I think very quickly that creates friends among people. And one of the kind of no-nos in the gym is to be on your phone and, you know, constantly looking, you know, on social media or any of that kind of stuff. So in a certain sense, it forces you to get out of that world. It takes you from the mind back into the physical body. And in a very real way, you have to, because if you're living in your mind, you're not going to reach your goals. Because if you're constantly wondering if you can do it or anything, you just have to do it. You just have to get in there and do it and put forth the effort with the body.
Yep.
So you're right. I mean, I, you know, some of my best friends are because we lift weights together.
Well, what about the thing that goes the other way, though? Okay, so we can the gym provides an opportunity to talk about the why, and to it's a very grace building on nature image that you had there. Why this is great, but let's go. What about opening up to Christ? Then this becomes something more. But I would think a more common problem we have in the Christian churches is the person who does know Christ, but has doesn't know how this journey of self-mastery is supposed to work and may feel overwhelmed and already overweight or already, you know, living in a very isolated way. And so the fast food life or whatnot, then how do you approach that person, or what are the words that you might say to that person?
Yeah, you know, when they say, for example, you know, they ask me how I got to where I'm at. Well, I've been doing this for 17 years. I mean, this is something that I've been doing for a long time. And so now it's just completely second nature for me to get up early in the morning and go to the gym. It's not hard for me, but it took me some time and effort to get there. So I always say, start small. You know, start with something like a 30-day goal. You know, for example, one thing I'm really passionate about is that people don't drink enough water. It's always soda, it's always tea, it's always coffee, but very rarely do you see people just drinking water. And I think that's a hindrance to the body. And so I say, you know, try to drink, say, 6 to 8 glasses of water every day for the next 30 days. It's not that big of a goal. I mean, it's a small step in the right way. And just let that be your goal. Do everything else that you do, especially prayer life, all of the other stuff. You know, don't let this hinder anything else that you do, but allow yourself for 30 days to just knock out this one simple goal. And especially because, you know, if you can tap into that spiritual aspect of people who are already devoted to Christ and say, you know, the reason Lent is so important for us, and Advent is actually supposed to be an ascetic time too. But the reason that's so important is because it's preparing us for something. Right, we give up these things not just as a sacrifice in and of itself. It's preparing the soul for something great that's about to happen in our life. So if you tap into that and say, now, what's something you can do in your regular life too that can happen all year round? You know, that can happen day in and day out. And know that the goals will change. They'll kind of ebb and flow, and sometimes it's going to hurt. Sometimes it's going to feel great. You know, even something as simple as setting an alarm clock that's 30 minutes earlier than what you normally get up, and putting it across the room, have to get up. That small goal lends towards more morning prayer, or being able to cook breakfast for everybody, or, you know, doing something charitable, or building yourself up, or reading, or something like that, or exercising if that's what you want to do. But something as simple as for 30 days, get up 30 minutes earlier. That small goal is something that can kind of chip away at the needs and necessities that will ultimately take you to doing bigger and better things.
Jared Zimmerer is our guest. Thank you so much, Jared, for spending the time with us. It's just been a pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. My honor.
I want to make sure people know where they can connect with you. Word on Fire is probably the best place to get you. Is it wordonfire.com or?
Org.
Or .org. Okay, I wasn't sure. Yeah, so wordonfire.org, and you're there listed because you have to tell me you're Director of Outreach and Mission for mm-hmm. Word on Fire.
That's right.
And then you have a Facebook page and a Instagram people can get you at?
That's right. Yeah, if you just look me up on Facebook, Jared Zimmerer, on either Facebook or Instagram, works for me.
Very good. Jared Zimmerer, our guest. Again, thanks so much for being with us. I gotta go work out now. I gotta go do something. I gotta get moving. And thank you to all of our listeners. We sincerely appreciate it. Join us again next week on Catholic Answers Focus.